Ah, hello, friend. I was wondering when you might stop by. Come, take a seat. Warm your hands by the fire. Welcome to Stories from the Hearth, the podcast for tall tales and fantastical fiction. Short stories, the likes of which you might once have heard a bard tell to a group of villagers like you, gathered around the fire. This is an experiment in independent storytelling, a safe and inclusive space for you to relax, dream, explore and challenge yourself. Join me, Cal Bannerman, on the last Sunday of every month around this campfire, roaring in a clearing in the woods beneath a star-speckled sky, and lose yourself in a genre-bending tale of history, romance, science fiction, or fantasy. These are tales to transport you, doorways into another world. Stories from the Hearth is ad-free and free to listen to. Its existence depends entirely on the financial and moral support of its listeners. To support the podcast and earn yourself exclusive perks such as early access, behind the scenes, bonus stories, shoutouts, live chats, signed copies of the stories, and more, join me on Patreon from as little as £2 or $3 by heading to patreon.com/storiesfromthehearthpodcast or by hitting the link in the description below. My warmest thanks to those of the novice narrator tier and higher who helped to make this community possible. Mully, Ruthie, Vivian, Nick, Sandy, Jane, Rob, Charlie, and Jen. Thank you. Now, gather close, for I've got a story to tell. This is episode 19, Mother Peril and the Nuclear Disaster. The town was about as far north and east as you could go before you hit Black Sand, Black Sea, and schools of iceberg which lit the night vista like quiet apparitions, slowly melting back into the world which had once spawned them. The town lay at the tip of a peninsula, rippling just below the surface with volcanic pressure, though the residents hadn't seen an eruption in their lifetime. Despite the volcanoes and the fertility they brought to that region, life for the townsfolk was bleak. Snow covered the arable land for all but 3 months of the year. Wind coursed in off the sea of Okhotsk to batter at the corrugated housing and salt-stripped wooden storefronts. Its sound a continuous banshee howl, which perforated the residents' dreams, silenced their speech and ruined their ears, so much so that those who left the town always returned, citing an unbearable silence elsewhere in the country. Parks in that town were gravel, ice, and concrete. The sky never anything but grey. The cheeks of the townsfolk were blasted a permanent and infernal red, raw as the smoked pink fish, which was a delicacy in other parts of the world, but here was so abundant as to be detestable. There was no tourist industry in town. Though the government had tried its damnedest to promote the place as the country's most remote point, what few holidaymakers and backpackers did make the journey quickly turned around and left, often without even taking a single picture. Pictures in that town were of other places. In the town in which this story is set, work, life, play, even love revolved around the art of fishing. At 4, you were deemed old enough to harvest the shallower rock pools closest to the sea wall. There, children might find shrimp, mussels, razor clams, small crab, limpets, cockles, and whelks. All the onomatopoeic foods, the foods mimetic of mouthfeel. At 7, you'd join your parents collecting kelp at low tide to be dried on the shore for kombu and later dashi. From 10 onwards, provided you were a strong enough swimmer, you could venture out on the boats with the battle-hardened and insular fisherfolk on the hunt for the giant crab, octopus, squid and salmon of the treacherous, cold and dismal northern waters. When people in the town got together, which was often, since communal gatherings were quite literally their only reliable source of warmth, they talked about fishing, about the dangers, the deaths, the fabled catches of folkloric repute, the peacefulness and the boredom, about who the best fishers were versus who were the best finders. And, as ever, they talked about the peril. Nobody knew exactly how old the peril was, and theories about its origins ranged as wildly as the number of townsfolk who claimed ancestry with the original catcher. At first glance, there was nothing particularly out of the ordinary about this peril. It was as beautiful as any peril might hope to be, a nurtured, concentric, iridescent beauty whose alien qualities spoke to the care its molluscan mother had taken when forming it. What really separated this peril from others, however, was the fact that it was still growing. It had been growing now, the elders of that town said, for over 100 years, and it didn't appear as if it were going to stop anytime soon. The peril was that town's secret. Lifeless though their barren strip of land might have seemed to anyone else, the townsfolk living there stuck it out, enjoying good health, prosperous conversation, bon accord, and the bounty of the sea to ensure their bellies were rarely empty. All, they said, thanks to the generosity of the peril, around which they had built a grand temple of whalebone and sealskin down on the water's edge. True, they could probably have cashed in on the peril if they had wanted to, give the government another, better reason to make their small corner of the world a prominent feature on the tourist map. But time and again, they chose not to. Traditionally, the town's youth would argue with their parents and grandparents over the value of the peril. Stuck in uninspiring lives, they saw only the glitter and glamour of the lights, people, and potential that selling the peril, or marketing it somehow, might bring them. But then, as youth turned to wisdom, and the years of their exposure to the peril compounded one layer around the other, these same advocates for auction grew into ardent defenders of the town's strange secret. Year after year this happened. Children allowed themselves to grow from skeptics to true believers, to beget more children who would undergo the same process. The town was a shell, and each new generation a grain of sand irritating its fleshy lining, to be absorbed by the mystifying pool of that old, opaque orb. By the time of the nuclear disaster, the town's peril had grown to the size of a watermelon in its 6 generations of time there. After just a week of nuclear winter, however, it had grown as large as a car tire. A month later, and it took a team of 5 just to lift the peril from its stand, for to build it a bigger shrine. The nuclear power plant responsible for this disaster was the largest the mainland had ever seen. It had been conceived by a foreign scientist, a woman who some thought of as a genius, the modern Nikola Tesla, whilst others whispered in hushed conversation of the flaws in her plans. The administration in office back then, however, had cared only for numbers. The electricity produced in just one day of the plant's operation, said the scientist, would surpass that produced by a week of burning coal, or by 3 months of converting sunlight to energy. That, the politicians had decided, was good enough for them. When the climactic earthquake hit the island nation, it was but the latest in a long line of much smaller shakes that country citizens had felt, wobbling their houses, clanging their pots and unsteadying their feet over the past 24 hours. The magnitude of that final quake was not one which could be measured on any of the scales invented at that time. Buildings deemed to be earthquake-proof crumpled drunkenly to the streets. Stilted highways sank into fissures, yawning from the mantle like flies into Venus traps. Streets became tents and teepees of concrete cloth, their houses propped against each other, appearing as two battle lines of sumo wrestlers at stalemate. The workers at the power plant gritted their teeth when the quake came. They called their spouses, clutched their colleagues for comfort, expecting to hear alarm bells at any moment, indicating a rupture in the nuclear core. The fact that no siren sounded as the aftershocks began to fade only served to offer those unfortunate souls an untimely sliver of hope before their lives were finally rendered forfeit. You see, what followed that earthquake was a tsunami wave which swept inland like laughter. Nothing in its path posed an obstacle, and little was left protruding from the wash. In places, the wave towered to almost 10 stories tall, its waters a storm of human architecture and broken bodies which clapped against the earth and deafened the birds above. So loud and immediate was the devastation that in some of the evacuated regions, birds still sing out of tune. When the roaring waters laid siege to the walls of the nuclear plant, the cooling units were the first to lose power. Soon enough, the lake which had formed about the site as a moat around a castle began to steam and hiss wherever it came into contact with the rapidly heating chimneys. When, finally, pressure inside the plant became too much, cracks began to show. Tendrils of white lightning spiderwebbed up from the base of the reactors, sundering skyward. The concrete bulged, the ground held its breath. And then, as a dying star speaks its last with a vacuous contortion of light, the power plant exploded. Heat flew out from the core in an exponential curve, vaporizing the workers trapped on site in a millisecond. Plumes of radioactive ash burst forth and became the weather, turning lightning green and rainfall deadly. The sun went into hiding. Ironically, though the little northern outpost offered its residents next to no protection from the elements, the folk of that wee fishing town were kept almost entirely safe from the disaster. They felt no shocks, saw no increase in the sea's wrath compared to any other day. They knew nothing of their country's terrible plight, until, one morning, they woke to find everything in town covered in a fine layer of nuclear fallout. It was then, as the elders rushed to check on the health of their beloved pearl, rescued from the depths of the Pacific by a deified diver in the annals of that community's history, that they discovered it had almost doubled in size overnight, and, perhaps more curiously, had started glowing. The whole place, despite being accustomed to snow, looked surreal, plastered in that dusty beige ash the morning after the nuclear disaster. Whilst snow can seem to emit light, and thus bathe an otherwise ugly place in a sort of heavenly glow, the fallout dust which lay inch thick about town appeared instead to swallow light whole. As townfolk emerged from their huts and cottages that morning, they squinted their eyes, not for the brightness, but for the distinct lack of it. Their world was hazy and ill-defined, a place where buildings loomed suddenly out of nothingness in hard, bony angles, where neighbours staggered through the sickly fog just out of sight, so that the town seemed overrun by those terrible, nameless spirits, the Yurei, where not even the revolving bulb of the lighthouse burned bright enough to sear through the haze. Nobody spoke, not to each other, nor with themselves. They walked, shambling aimlessly from shop to boatshed to parked car and home again, shaking their heads and picking up things, ordinary things, shells, pebbles, plastic bags, the odd stray coin, just to put them in their pockets, as if the world they had known could somehow be preserved by weighing oneself to the earth with the stuff from it. Eventually, though, they all wound up congregating in the same place, by the seaside shrine to Ebisu, god of fishing, where a century or more ago the town had elected to keep their peril. There, the silent masses gathered, and there, they began to weep together. A collective elation, confusion, and reverence spilling over into tears, to see deep within the core of the peril a sliver of golden, buttery light swirl and swim. Through layers and layers of ever-changing conchiolin, at once blue, pink, purple, cream and petroleum, at once colourless, a velveteen lustre radiated. It spilled out through the pearlescent body and fell upon upraised faces of the townsfolk, as if the shrine god himself were come to bestow upon that community the ocean's bounty. For the longest time that day, nobody talked, worked, even ate, but instead stood transfixed under the miniature aurora borealis of the pearl light, which no ancestor of that place had ever before seen. At some point, the shrine priest cleared her throat, offered a blessing to Ebisu. In it, she dared to suggest that the pearl might have been a gift sent from him all those years ago, specifically for the purpose of curing the world of the poison now spewing from its crippled reactors. "Do not forget," boomed the priest, "that our ancestors recovered Mother Pearl from a shipwreck on the deepest part of the sea floor. Drawn there, they were, by a light which reached out to them and kept them from losing their way, from drowning in the currents of the deep blue. For a century or more, we northerners have cherished Mother Pearl, kept her safe and well served, offered sacrifice to her, and in return have been rewarded a fine measure of peace. And for six count generations, Mother Pearl has swollen with our love and reverence. Our ancestors worshipped her, even though they knew not what we know now, that she has much more to grow, that the light which guided those first divers lives still within her breast. Oh, great God Ebisu, gather my neighbours and rejoice. Fear not the night that lasts the day, for Mother Pearl shall be our guiding light, our torch in darkest need. At our direst hour, she reveals herself to us and gives us that which we lack most, truth." In the immediate aftermath of the disaster, the country was too preoccupied with its own recovery to pay much attention to the strange happenings of a backwater settlement in its least prosperous and least affected region. At some point, though, the peril became impossible to ignore. 3 months after the nuclear power plant erupted, and with nearly 1 million people displaced, left to wandering the roads in search of work and hospitality, the glowing pearl had grown to the size of a small house. And though the townsfolk endeavoured as always to keep their prize a secret, it wasn't long before refugees of the tsunami happened upon that strange part of the world, and in turn discovered what generations of its natives had striven to keep hidden. News quickly spread to the next town along, and then the next, and in what seemed like no time at all, the whole country, and then the whole world, had heard of the phenomenon. Like crows to the carrion, national news channels began elevating updates about the peril above talk of the emergency, presumably with hopes of distraction. Whilst international media outlets, governments and environmentalist think tanks alike condemned the peril as a sign that radiation in the region had reached uncontainable levels. Still other broadcasters seized on the opportunity to tout their conspiracy theories, whilst religious nuts saw to it that the peril was known far and wide, either as the second coming of Christ, Mohammed and Malachi, or the devil, heralding the end times. No matter what outsiders thought of the strange pulsing orb, however, in that grey little town where the fisherfolk fished, the peril still symbolised hope. Refugees, spiritualists, government men and strangers of all kinds filled up the few guest houses in town. They swarmed the peril as villagers to an ogre's den, some flinging stones, some hugging it, others vlogging about it for cash. They stuck probes into it for tests, held orgies at its base and ejaculated on it. They punched it, kicked it, kissed it, blessed it, cursed it, blamed it, and named it. And always they sought to contain it. Contain it within some framework which they might understand, no matter whether it be one of good, evil, or indifference. But they didn't stop there. Soon, the transient masses turned to the roadsides outside town to erect villages of ramshackle tents by the thousands. Food shortage quickly became a reality, where once the sea had provided for all. Fights broke out in local bars where once the watering holes had provided sanctuary. The town, a typically serene and quiet, if uninteresting place, suddenly became a vision of a whole nation's ill-prepared panic. Fires burned in empty oil drums all hours of the dingy day, the stink from them thickening the air like tripe soup. And all the while, the peril shone, the peril grew. Nuclear fallout fell, the land decayed, and people prayed. In hindsight, the cult of the peril was inevitable. It was actually impressive just how quickly so many of the newcomers began venerating the sea treasure, and in ways which the original inhabitants of that town never had. The original inhabitants thought of the peril fondly, like a childhood blanket or teddy bear. To them, it could not have held any value to those who had not grown up around it. To them, it was imbued with protective, restorative qualities because of its ties to their past. But it was still a curio which they admitted they knew very little about. Their minds were open. On the contrary, the newcomers clung to the peril like a dying woman to her memories of health, or like a leper to their sloughing skin. They craved the peril. They loved it. They obsessed over the peril as men do, who should be left loveless until they can mature. The newcomers needed the peril, but the peril didn't need them. Instead, the peril just kept on growing, and its internal light grew along with it. Soon, that small grey town was awash every moment of every day with the most transcendent light show seen anywhere in the world. Life there, though harder than ever, seemed at least slightly hopeful. Even as the last of the vegetable rations perished, even as the dried meat took on the rot and maggots of seafront damp, even as the people's bellies tightened and doubled over, or tore themselves apart, producing too much acid to dissolve the boiled rice which was their only fare, still they clung on to that hope. As long as the peril stayed, they said, so would they. When the army finished evacuating the area around the destroyed nuclear plant, they turned their attentions on the town. It was as if they'd gotten a taste for it, evacuating people, and hungered to turn folk from their houses wherever they got the opportunity. The peril they appeared to treat just like another nuclear reactor on the verge of collapse. Of course, the town's natives protested, tried to explain the peril's significance, its age, and its goodness of nature. But they may as well have been speaking a different language, for the generals would not bat an eye. By that point, the peril had grown so large that its shadow cast the entire tip of the coastline in permanent midnight. It was about as big as the meteor responsible for the extinction of the dinosaurs, and most of the town's infrastructure had already been crushed beneath its immense weight. The scale of it confused people. They would stand and stare at the peril, bemused, with starstruck eyes and empty minds. They simply could not fathom how something from the Earth could get to be so big, whilst they, the apex species, remember, were rendered inconsequential. By the time the tanks rolled into the outskirts of town, passing long lines of mourners dragged unwillingly from the great shining globe, and as battle cruisers dropped anchor many miles offshore, the peril could be seen not just from outer space, but by anyone living anywhere in the same hemisphere as it. Thus, when the leader of that country ordered her ships to launch a preemptive nuclear strike on the peril, the mushroom clouds should have been seen by nearly 3.97 billion people. The irony was not lost on the country's leaders as they launched their 5 warheads at the peril, each bomb infinitesimally more powerful than those which had so completely and irreversibly altered that nation's timeline a century earlier. But then, when has irony ever cooled the tempers of humanity? When has irony ever changed their minds? As the soldiers and engineers aboard JS Haguro donned their sunglasses and looked out toward the horizon, eagerly awaiting the X-ray flashes, bangs, and erasure of the sonic barrier, one was aware of the excitement on deck. It was palpable. 1,000 men and women ready to avenge themselves of national pain with a war against a thing unfeeling, unknowing, unsuspecting, and thus, they felt, a target justifiable. They stood and waited, watching the chemtrails of their rockets arch like a bridge to Valhalla across the crisp blue sky, their hearts palpitating, hands clenching, mouths watering, groins gurning. They stood and watched the missiles make their target, acupuncture relieving a pregnant belly. And they waited. Waited for the thunderous cry, waited for the clouds like fungal monuments to extinction-level events of every epoch. They waited, but nothing came. Their faces were those of spurned gentlemen whose egos have yet to catch on. On shore, the shrine priest's youngest daughter watched the rocket's approach with tears in her eyes. She had been the only resident to escape the careful combing of the military men, and thus stay close to the elegant, otherworldly curves of the peril. When the nuke struck home, she was the only person to see what really happened. Instead of exploding on impact, the bombs passed through the peril's outer shell as if it were made of wax, each disappearing with a small sucking sound like guppy mouths on wet sand. As the last of the missiles was absorbed, she watched the light inside the peril bloom to the size of a small moon, before suddenly collapsing in on itself, withdrawing forever from the world the gift of its splendid colours. From a veritable peacock tail of cool, calming floral hues, it reduced itself to a deep well of wine red and piercing orange, a ball of furious iridescence oscillating at the core of the pearl with vibrations so fast they tricked the eye to thinking they had gone completely and eerily still. The girl watched on, screaming in horror at all her kind were capable of, wailing for a return to the days when the folk who knew of the peril numbered few and had treated it with childlike kindness. She died in the throes of her lamenting, smeared to a thick paste by the rapid expansion of her prized peril. A second volley of nukes was absorbed just like the first, though now, as the offending boats rolled in as close as they dared to observe the damage wrought, the light inside the pearl turned blue-black and quiet. Out to sea, a gentle wind rose and fell. On the boats, sailors frowned at a change in the air, a distinct lack of gull calls rendering the scene tense and unsettling. For a long while, nothing moved. Had anyone been particularly observant, they might have noticed a slight slowing in the Earth's rotation, a momentary lapse in gravity, as if somewhere deep within that planet, a sentience stirred, drawn to waking by what it saw was now inevitable and regrettable. The breath which gripped the world broke, and the peril began to grow again. This time, though, it accelerated outwards from its darkened centre faster than ever before. So fast that not even the motorcade shepherding people from the island could get out of its way. To the sound of a great fractious rending of bone, towns, villages, cities, farms, animals, trees, people, even mountains were crushed beneath the polished sphere. Soon, it occupied the majority of the island it was on and stretched to such heights that the top half of it was hidden in cloud cover. Then, just when it seemed as though it could grow no larger without breaching the very ozone, it cracked. Onto a desperate world fell an immense jigsaw piece of nacreous peril. Like a castle drawbridge, or the polished chrome gangplank of a spaceship, it landed at an angle against the rocky shoreline far below, its other end at the hole it had just created. Inside the peril, something stirred. Helminthine, the interior of that great orb, writhed and squelched in the darkness. It was a mouth diseased, a gaping wound in the side of some mythical beast, a wormhole, a tear, an accident, disgrace. With the sucking sound of skin on skin, something monolithic within the peril came dislodged, and down the shell ramp spilled the source of its internal light, light which had given so many such a deal of hope, except no longer. For whatever luminescence had once curled tightly within the walls of that fragile prison was now irreversibly changed. From out of the hole gushed impossible waterfalls of gelatinous brown sludge, bubbling hot and distorting the scene with its heat waves. The flow of it was rapid and churning, scorching whatever life still remained on its path to the sea, whereupon it emulsified, creating massive globular bergs, battleships, and floating mines of its own. Into these patches of oceanic effluent were pooled that entire short-sighted navy of hovering gunboats and transport vessels, as gently as lily pads into a whirlpool. The wails of the crews ended with a gurgle. The peril took its time releasing upon the earth the matured viscera of its waters. When eventually it lay nestled in a groaning swamp of its own excretion, it began to evacuate itself of something altogether different and altogether more terrible. What spilled forth was a clear liquid, as lumpy as half-cooked eggs and mottled with massive chunks of peeling flesh. Loose enamel shards the length of buses, which skewered the earth like arrow fire. And, finally, droplets of an inky substance as blue as the skin of space. It was only when the peril had drained itself of all internal fluids that the child at last emerged. A sigh came from the crater in the side of the peril, sweeping land and sea for miles about with a breath so foul flowers wilted in its wake. Piece by piece, the thing inside began dismantling its gigantic shell, the fragments of calcium carbonate shattering upon the world below like godly dandruff. The child broke free with one final tremendous effort, and a shriek so inhuman, some say it shall resonate forever into the stars. The child who emerged from the peril was enormous. Its many limbs ended in a confusing array of appendages. Claws, suckers, beaks, and taloned paws. Some with dexterous posable digits, others evolved with no clear purpose of use to speak of. The skin covering the child's body, itself warped and bulging in painfully distended joints and softly oozing blisters, was in places as furry as a snow monkey, or as suggestively smooth as a human, and in others was encased in armoured shell, red and white like the king crabs for which that region's cuisine was so famed. Upon its head, if you could call the protrusion from its stomach a head, were long shrimp-stalk eyes and a jawless mouth overflowing with yellowed tombstone molars arrayed like a shark's. It had no nose. The child tumbled from its pearlescent egg. It stood up slowly, a low whine elucidating the depths of its agony for all within earshot, which coincidentally was all the earth. It was not quite as tall as the peril had been, but the tip alone of its reptilian tail, bending awkwardly out from the glass shards of a bloodied spine, was thicker and longer than a blue whale. The child looked about itself, witnessing the destruction its birth had brought to the small town which had raised it, cared for it, nurtured it over the years. It roared then, and its tears created lakes of the land, washing away all the debris of its arrival so that soon it had space to sit, to hold itself, and to weep. But the child would not be let alone. It desired only the solace a peril does, clamped tightly in the underwater comfort of its oyster. It desired only to know itself and the reasons for its pain. The child knew only one thing, and that was the natural impulses of its kind, which, in the body it found itself trapped in, it could not manifest. It examined itself and grew more confused, not knowing what it saw, but knowing that it was wrong. But the child would not be left alone. The first bullets struck the child in the knee of a leg, the consistency of a jellyfish tentacle. The second barrage pierced its pointed chin. Soon, all of the child was a noise of prickling pain, gunfire, and fear. It tried to call out to its attackers, too small for it to see. Tried to beg them to stop, to listen and understand it, to treat it as the youngling that it was. But its tongue felt thick in its throat, and the sounds which emerged were strangled. At the noise, its aggressors only increased the violence of their assault, launching now rockets which singed and scorched the child's back. Suddenly, a bomber's engines droned across the sky, bringing with them a compounding of the child's pain. The bomber opened his hatch and flicked another switch in the cockpit. Job done, he didn't even turn to watch as his carpet bomb fell from the clouds to wreathe the child's shoulders in synthetic fire. The skin there didn't melt instantly. It clung on, tortuously stubborn, before it could sustain its hold on the child no longer, and began dripping to the ground in drops of scalding blubber. The child screamed, and then was silent, overcome and numb. Shocked by the falling quiet, the attackers seized fire long enough to watch as through the clearing smoke, the child stretched out a torn and twisted set of scaly wings, freed by chance from the flesh folds tying them to its back. It stood then, surprised by the sudden change in its anatomy, and slowly beat its wings. It came to relish the magnificent coolness of wind churning about its wounds. It beat its wings faster, marvelling at how they could blot out all other sound, how they could shield the child from hearing the shouts of the ground troops as they were plucked from the earth as easily as crumbs blown from a worktop. Cocooned in its auditory enclosure, the child could not hear the squealing crunch of metal on metal as its great wing beats threw tanks together like a baby might smoosh its plastic playthings. The child kept on beating its wings until it felt the world fall away beneath it. It beat its wings until the cauterizing flesh of its body cooled and set and crusted and sloughed off, healing faster than anybody should. It beat its wings and leaned into the wind, its movements instinctive, instructed by some small measure of innate and intact biology. It flew and it passed over an island nation of crumbling buildings and waterlogged streets. It tasted in the air the rancid, unnatural chemicals which it had first sensed in the womb, which had pierced its amniotic sac in the shuddering moments before premature birth. The child danced along the currents, twisted and deformed, high up where no one could see nor hurt it. And in that moment of perfect clarity, it came to understand its purpose. It understood why it had let itself be discovered all those years ago by a lone diver off the coast of a smoking charcoal rock. Intimately, it came to know the symbiosis by which its species had evolved, a mutual dependency on another, that in doing so, it might elevate that other species above their station, to new heights of consciousness, contentment, and discovery. The child's kind had played at this game for as long as there had been games to play. Some of the species they had already awakened came to think of them as elders, the sublimed, or, most often, as gods. Few species had ever abused and rejected emissaries of the child's species quite so completely nor so hastily as this. The thought was black as endless purgatory in the child's mind. Hopeless beyond hopelessness, it was sour, rotten, sacred and cold. The child quailed. With rage in all of its hearts, the child quivered, trembled, quaked. As it did, it shook free from its pores all the loathsome pollution which that planet had drowned it in. Radiation spores littered the air, thick clouds of the stuff forming wherever the child flew. On and on it went, never stopping, never ceasing its tears nor reining in its anger. In the child's wake, acid rain and slow, painful mutation, such as had tormented the child in its gestation, scrubbed from the world all signs of complex life. Wiped the slate clean of sentience. only when the child was sure that it had left not one inch of populous land unfettered by its deathly shadow, did it turn toward the stars and finally allow a resigned curiosity to replace its fury. Through the atmosphere it broke, the pressure of the journey correcting many of the most painful misalignments and distensions of its skeleton, so that when it emerged under the distant starlight, it was more impressive of a creature than ever before. Now, at long last, it moved graceful and lithe, just as its people had evolved to do trillions of light years ago, at the very nucleus of the universe. Now, it shone with a recognizable luster, was made of a myriad different colors, translucencies and textures, which changed as it twisted and turned. The child swam out into the infinite dark, never looking back, listening instead for the call of another world, with another folk who might love it better than the last. It contemplated the dissonance between those quiet, kind-hearted fisherfolk and the violence of their neighbours. It contemplated the contradictions of early phase intelligence. It contemplated its own bereavement and the guilt it felt at what it had left behind. But still, it kept flying. Flying until the pale blue dot behind it was as imperceptible as it was fast becoming meaningless. Flying until the starlight stretched and distorted around it, bending to enshrine the child once more in a womb of motherly, otherworldly pearlescence. Thank you for listening to this month's Story from the Hearth. It's been an interesting month or two for me. I got COVID, which was not fun at all. Despite three vaccinations, it still really knocked me out. I moved flat, and I'm now living on my own, which is in itself something to get used to. And in the mire of all of that, I think my head has felt so cloudy, it became really difficult to kind of invest in the writing of anything. I started and stopped two different stories. I got toward the end of both of them and then just couldn't close. I couldn't finish them. I didn't know where they were going. But I still wanted to produce something and I still love doing this. So I sat down and in a day, after staring at a blank word processor page for an entire hour, I kind of churned out this story. It just came to me very naturally and kind of full-formed. And I think in it are perhaps a lot of my sort of frustrations with, I don't know, with everything, with the world, with our approach to environmentalism, with our approach to capitalism, with our approach to energy and armaments, war, with our approach to parenthood and community, but which is not to say that it's a story born of frustration. I mean, I also wanted to write something quite beautiful with a real focus on like the poetry of the words, which admittedly might have bogged it down some, but you know, I think this is maybe how to put it best. I didn't want any human to have a voice in it, right? Like, it's very interesting as a writer, I think, to try and divorce yourself from, like, the way that we would usually tell stories, which is always from the perspective of a human or as relating to a human, right? The only person that speaks in that story is the priestess. And to be completely honest, the only reason she speaks is to kind of very briefly ground the rest of the story of the peril and the child in what it means or what they mean to the humans around them. It wasn't really to sort of give the humans agency. I really wanted to write a story that didn't concern a damn person. I just felt bored, you know? I just felt bored writing from characters' perspectives and just thinking, what, like, you know, what are they doing? What is the, like, what's the point in this? I wanted to write the story of a completely otherworldly being that is, for half of the story, not even really a being, it's a peril. And I just wanted to write that story so that I could kind of experiment with my own ability to, like, write something compelling that you can't really particularly relate to. And I don't know, I wonder how that came across. As always, I'll be writing a much more in-depth, behind the scenes sort of expose of the inspirations behind this, because there's a lot I'm not talking about here. Like, there are a lot of pop culture inspirations, there are a lot of other personal inspirations that have went into this story. So as ever, I'll be writing a behind the scenes blog post for Patreon and all of my Patreon supporters. There'll also be, they've obviously gotten access to this a week early, and there'll be other wee exclusive bits and pieces to do with this story going up on Patreon too. So if you want to hear a little bit more, you know, head to patreon.com/storiesfromthehearthpodcast. This episode, episode 19, is going to be the last for a while. I'm going to take the summer off, which means no story episodes for June, July, August. I might even go so far as into the autumn or the fall as well. I'll be back by Christmas, not Christmas, I'll be back by winter, absolutely. And I kind of hope to be back by the fall as well. But it's proven a lot. It's proven a lot. I absolutely love doing this. It has pushed me to be more creative in my day-to-day life than I think I've ever been before. But also, as I say, I've moved into my own place. Rent is more expensive. Bills are more expensive. Food is more expensive. The cost of living crisis is very real. And so I'm having to devote a lot of my time, a lot more of my time than I would like, to my copy editing and copywriting, the stuff that actually, you know, kind of brings in regular income. I'm also writing a book, and I'm finding it difficult to dedicate the time that that book needs to be good while still operating the podcast. And furthermore, I'm also playing catch up, right? I'm recording this about 5 days before I release it on Patreon. Now, usually I'd like to have an episode recorded and produced, you know, a month ahead of time. But I'm, at the moment, I'm really finding that I'm playing catch up a lot, because that's just the way of life, right? Like, yeah, at some points you start playing catch up. And I don't want to do that. I want to really take time to really hone these stories, really kind of reduce them down to the very best that they can be. And that's not to say I'm not very proud of this story. I am. But I don't want to feel the pressure and stress of the writing process. I want the writing process to still be a very natural and enjoyable experience for me. So I hope you will all understand. I deeply, deeply appreciate every single one of you listening to this right now. I mean, it is still kind of crazy to me that, you know, I'm not doing an audio drama that's like a sort of episodic thing that you can, like, follow one concrete story for a year. I'm not doing a conversational podcast with, like, celebrities. You know, this is, or like a historic podcast on a topic you're really interested in. Like, people listening to this have put their faith in me as an artist and a storyteller and a writer to entertain them and perhaps open them up to new perspectives. And just kind of feel a little bit blown away that people would do that. So thank you so much for listening to this. As I say, this will be the last story for a few months. I'll put updates up on my social medias, at Stories from the Hearth on Instagram and at Hearth underscore podcast underscore. I think that's it, right? Like the flat line on the bottom of the line. At Hearth underscore podcast. I'll put updates as to when I'm coming back. But for now, like, if you're enjoying this, if you like it, please do tell other people. That is always how podcasts grow, right? Like, I think my favorite podcasts, which are like The Adventure Zone, I love. This is Important with the Workaholics guys I'm really into right now. Daniele Valelli's History on Fire, which is just incredible. All of these things, I think I was introduced to by someone saying, like, you've got to listen to this, you'll love it. So if you could help me to reach more people that might enjoy this art that I'm producing, then please do. Please go and tell people. And if you feel like this podcast brings your day a little bit of extra value, if it, I don't know, just, you know, calms you down or entertains you or helps you get off to sleep at night, consider supporting me on Patreon. I know it's always a lot to ask whenever money is involved. And I know a lot of people just kind of go like, this is the time to switch off the podcast. And you know what? I get it. I totally get it. We're all struggling right now. That's not true. The oligarchs and one percenters of the world are very much not struggling. They're laughing. But the majority of us are struggling right now. And to sign up for any sort of like subscription service or to, you know, donate money, it's a big ask, especially when you're scraping pennies together to get through the month. And if that's your situation, I do not want you to consider subscribing on Patreon. However, if you have the means to do so, you can sign up on Patreon from £2 per month, which is about $3. You can do it, you know, one off if you want. You can subscribe for 3 months. You can subscribe for 12. You can, it's rolling monthly. So you can subscribe for as long as you like. There are graded tiers from £2, then £4, then £8 and so on. And with each tier, you get a different set of perks, which include early access to the show, bonus episodes every single month, behind the scenes posts on each story episode, shout outs, chats with me on Discord. You get to vote on various things. You get to make requests. There's potential for merch in the future. You can even get like physical signed copies of these stories, or even have me like personally, like you can commission me to write a personalized story or poem, whatever you like, for you. There's lots and lots of things that you can get through the Patreon, and it is honestly inextricably linked to the survival of this podcast. The money that comes in from Patreon each month is immediately reinvested in the podcast, whether that's like just marketing, whether that's paying for my time, whether that's paying for better quality foley and sound and music. And the more people who subscribe, the more people who sign up, the bigger the community grows around Stories from the Hearth and around storytelling and story listening in general. The bigger the community grows, and the community is full of people who are like-minded, who are open-minded, who long for that sort of comfort that is taken from sitting around, you know, the virtual fire and listening to a story being told. And the more people who sign up to the Patreon, the more I can do with this podcast. I have grand plans. I want it to involve many other people that are not just me. I want this podcast to kind of embrace storytellers from all over the world. I want to do lots of different little interviews with people. I want to expand the content that is being produced through the podcast. At the moment, however, it's just me. I write it, I edit it, I record it, I produce it, I publish it, I publicize it. And I can only do so much in the month that I've got each time. So yeah, if you like this, support me in any way you can, whether that's rating the podcast out of 5 stars on Spotify, whether that's telling your friend, your mum, your granny, your son to go and listen to your favorite episode, your favorite story, whether that's just getting in touch to tell me what you like or what you find difficult about this story, drop me a message anytime. Just go out and spread the news. You can find the email address, Patreon link, Instagram handle, and Twitter handle down in the description below on whatever podcast app or Spotify or YouTube, however you're watching this. This will be the last story episode of Stories from the Hearth until the winter, most likely, of 2022. I'll be pausing Patreon payments in the meantime, so even if you want to sign up, nothing will be charged to you until I'm back and making content, because otherwise that's not fair. Until next we meet,